There's no I in team, but there is one in Indeed, and that's the hiring platform that you need to build yours. When you're hiring, you need Indeed. Instead of spending hours on multiple job sites searching for candidates with the right skills, Indeed's a powerful hiring platform that can help you do it all. One of the things I love about Indeed is that it makes hiring all in one place so easy because Indeed does the hard work for you. They show you the candidates whose resumes on Indeed fit your description immediately after you post so you can hire faster. Join more than 3 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. Start hiring now with a $75 sponsored job credit to upgrade your job post at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Offer good for a limited time. Claim your $75 credit now at Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. That's Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. And support the show by saying that you heard it on this podcast. Indeed.com/BlueWire Sports. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Back, everybody, to another episode of Benched with Bubba, episode 265. We're talking some more baseball movies, ranking 6 through 10. Last week, we did 11 through 15. In order to break them all down with me once again, you can find them on Twitter at Ben J. Palmer. Ben, how are you doing, man?
I'm doing all right. Tomorrow was supposed to be opening day, so I'm a little sad. Or today, depending on when you're listening to this, or yesterday or last week. I don't know when you're going to listen to this. But yeah, I know tomorrow is supposed to be opening day and then it's not.
Yeah, it sucks. Like, I've been trying to be like one of the optimistic ones out there, but I'm also a realist and it's not looking good. I'm just going to say it's not looking good at all.
Man, but I know.
It's real tough.
It sucks, man. Everything sucks. I've been quarantined. You know what's funny is I realized this today. I've been quarantined in my house. I have not left my house for the past, I want to say, 4 days, and I just realized it.
That's impressive.
I was this evening. I was like, oh, I haven't been outside in the past 4 days, and that's kind of when you know that hasn't really affected your life all that much.
yeah. You're like, oh, wait a minute. I guess this is okay.
Yeah, I guess this is different.
Yes, this is the new normal, as they say. It's a nuts. Weird deal. I still have to leave every day and go to work for a bit, but when I come home.
Oh, for real?
Yeah, I work in agriculture. So.
Oh, so you're essential.
Yeah, we keep making food. So that's just kind of the way the world goes around.
That makes sense.
But it's a lot quieter out there, a lot fewer interactions. Let's just put it that way. And my offices are pretty much closed. It's kind of a work out of my vehicle operation.
So. Yeah, especially in California. I would imagine there's nobody out doing anything.
Well, it's hit and miss. And that's the problem, and that's the problem you see around the country. It's like no one's doing this all together, it seems like, and it's making it very complicated. That's just how it is in California. Each it's like a county by county basis. It seems like it's about almost halfway installed now, maybe a little more. It's like the big cities are really, like LA and San Francisco they're hardcore lockdowns, but the rest of them, you know, last Saturday I had to go to the store and the park still had people at them doing stuff. So it's a little frustrating.
Yeah, that is frustrating.
Yeah. So, but that's not what everyone's here to listen to. They're here to talk about some baseball movies. Again, we did up 11 through 15 last time. It's a lot of fun. And like I said, I love talking with Ben about these because A, he loves baseball. B, he loves movies. And C, he watches movies that I've never even heard of. And it's really cool. And we're going to have some more of them on this one, and I have like my little 2 cent brain where I watch like Little Big League and Rookie of the Year and stuff like that. So it's like it's a good mix and match of a little bit of everything out there. But let's just kick it off. Who's your number 10, Ben?
My number 10 is another documentary about a league and a team that I knew nothing about coming into this, and it was a wild story. It's the Battered Bastards of Baseball. The Battered Bastards of Baseball, it's on Netflix if you want to watch it. It is about the Portland Mavericks, which were a team that was formed by Bing Russell, who is the father of Kurt Russell. And Bing Russell, for those who don't know, was a well-known actor on his own. Portland, Oregon, in the 70s, lost their minor league affiliate. And Bing Russell, who loved baseball and was pretty well known for being on Bonanza, and played a little bit of minor league baseball himself, decided to create his own baseball team, basically outside of Major League Baseball. And it's crazy. It's crazy to hear about who Bing Russell was. He was just this super charismatic guy who just decided, you know what, I'm gonna create my own team, and you know what, we're just gonna do it. And it's the movie is like a real life Field of Dreams. He just built this independent team of all these misfits from some from Major League Baseball. They had a left-handed catcher, which, you know, is weird. And they also had Jim Boughton, who was a former Yankees pitcher who was totally blackballed from Major League Baseball. And he just kind of created his own league, which is, it's just wild. And the whole team that he put together is just filled with all these crazy characters. It's just a lot of fun. It just seems like, honestly, that this was a team and a league that was created just because, out of pure love of baseball. And they were just a bunch of like misfits having fun. And it was really cool. I had never heard the story. But it was it's a well done documentary, pretty straightforward sports documentary. But like I said in the last podcast, you know, even straightforward interview-based documentaries can be really interesting if the story is interesting, and the story is really, really interesting. If you've never heard of the Portland Mavericks, you should totally check this out. It is a fascinating documentary.
I have to check this out. I'm so intrigued by this because it's kind of stuff we talked about last time, at least kind of in vain of my little big league thoughts of when you're young and can, you know, manage a team and run a team now. Bing Russell just uses basically his money and his tout to start his own league. Like, these are just things, like, we play fantasy baseball to run our own teams in a league. Like, this is what we do. He just did it in real life.
Yeah, he literally created. So the Portland Mavericks actually operated from 1973 to 1977.
Awesome.
They were originally the only independent club, and then some other independent teams started forming around the country. But yeah, it's a fun documentary and a fun story, and Kurt Russell does pop up in it real quick. He talks about he actually was as a kid and as a teenager, or not a teenager. I'm sorry. He actually played. That's right. I forgot when he was born. He actually played ball for the Mavericks for 1 year. Kurt Russell did. Their very first year, he played for them. But he was involved with the team a bit. But yeah, it's a cool story. It's a fun story.
Oh, that's awesome. I'm just going to add that to my list of movies that Ben has seen that I haven't. That sound just great. Great to watch.
Super easy to watch. It's on Netflix. If you're quarantined and looking for something to do, it's on there.
That sounds outstanding. My number 10 is, I'll give a brief talk on it, and then we can either talk about it now or later deeper, because I know it's on your list coming up here. But my number 10 is 61.
Good choice. I love that.
I love this movie because, like I said last podcast, like 11 through 15, for the most part, is like my nostalgia, like kids stuff. Now we're going to, outside of, you know, the Sandlot eventually, a lot of these are going to be more, these are baseball movies that hit home either because of the realistic nature of it, the history of it, something along those lines. And 61 does that. I remember, I'm not a big book reader, and I, especially as a kid, I was not a big book reader, and I read The Summer of 61. I just love everything about this. I don't know if it was because of the home run barrage when we were younger with, you know, Bonds and Sosa and all them. And that's when you started learning about Roger Maris more, if you didn't already know about Roger Maris. But just this movie was awesome because it showcased how, like, if you didn't want to read a book, it showed how quiet and just subtle of a guy Roger Maris was. It showed the flamboyance and just nature of Mickey Mantle, and then the Yankees in the early 60s, and how crazy that summer was when, you know, Maris is going for the record, which is to break Babe Ruth's record, another Yankee, obviously. It just showed this whole dynamic of it and gave a pretty good history lesson, but also gave a kind of a Hollywood cinematography of it as well. So it wasn't just, you know, it wasn't pure documentary for those that don't like documentaries, which I do. So I like, that's why you pick some of those out, but it gave you a little bit of both. And it wasn't like corny, like the Babe. It wasn't something like that. This is actually a good movie. Billy Crystal, who's a diehard baseball fan, I think he did it pretty good justice to it also. As the director, like, he, you could tell he loved this. He's a Yankees fan, he's a baseball fan, and you could see it kind of portrayed out in the way the movie was made. So I absolutely love 61. It's a great history movie, but it's also a great baseball movie, and that's why I love it. So that's my number 10.
Yeah, it's we can talk about it now, because I've got it at number 7, got a little bit higher than you, but I liked it a lot. I had never heard of the movie before I started creating, probably about a little over a year ago, I started creating a list of every baseball movie I could find to watch for this article, and I came across 61, and I had never heard of it. It came out in 2001. It was a HBO movie before we really cared about HBO movies, and it was really well done. Like you said, you can tell Billy Crystal really cared about this movie. He really cared about doing it right and making it look authentic. And I loved that. I knew about Roger Maris. Obviously, I knew who Mickey Mantle was. I didn't know a whole lot about their home run race, but this was a really cool look into it. It was a really, really interesting character study of Mantle and Maris, because they were both such different people. And huge credit to Barry Pepper, who plays Maris, who I think is a heavily underrated actor.
Big time.
Painfully underrated actor. But major credit to him and Thomas Jane, who plays Mantle. They both do a fantastic job. Barry Pepper especially is so good. He's really able to play this version of Maris, who is very self-doubting and quiet, and just kind of thrown into the spotlight that he didn't really know how to handle. And he also, honestly, if you look at pictures of Barry Pepper and Roger Maris, they look a lot alike.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Insanely good.
Yeah. But I love the way it was filmed. The color is beautiful. The art direction. It's a really, really well-made and just criminally underrated movie, period. And I think the reason it's underrated is because it was an HBO movie in 2001, and we kind of, you know, I think it just didn't get the publicity it deserved. I will say, just forewarning to those who haven't seen it, it does kind of frame the film around Mark McGwire breaking Maris's home run record, which, you know, in 2001 was cool. Now has kind of lost its luster a little bit, but still, it's a really, really good movie. It's excellent.
And I'm glad they made it when they did, because, yeah, sure, they use the McGwire thing to kind of frame it in the moment, but it led a lot of people, because, like, yeah, you and I that are baseball fans, we knew Maris, Mantle, the whole shebang, but a lot of people probably had no idea why McGwire, like Maris's family was following McGwire around stadiums, besides that he had a record. Like, they didn't realize outside of that one year, that was like the mecca of what he did. He was a good ball player, but it was always the Mickey Mantle show. And the fact that he showed up and did that was quite the accomplishment. And I think he needed a little more notoriety behind it all. So it was very good they did it, because it's one of those, you know, if we talk about, because, you know, now there's McGwire, then there's Bonds. And if you want to, that's a whole other podcast on what you believe in that situation. But
right.
Not many people are going to know who, you know, people 20 years from now aren't even going to know who Roger Maris is. So,
yeah. Well, it's so funny. You look at Maris's career, and, like, he had a great, so 1960, the year before the record breaking season, really, really good year. But then 61, when he hit 61 home runs, he hit 269, had 132 runs and 142 RBI. That's
insane. And a short season. Look at the number of games.
Well, he played 161 games.
Oh, I'm thinking of something else. Never mind. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. But after that, he was like solid. The next year, he hit 256 with 33 home runs, 100 RBI. That's solid. It's good. But just kind of trailed off after that. But that 1 year in 61, man, 132 runs, 142 RBI. That's crazy.
Yeah, I recommend if anybody does like to read books, read The Summer of 61, I believe is what it's called. And it's really cool. It gives an even deeper look to what the movie basically did. So I would highly recommend it for me that's bored and likes to read. I check it out. But all right, you're number nine. This one, you went to the Wayback Machine. So I'll flat out say, never seen it. Never even heard of it. So
this was another one when I was looking for baseball movies. I came across it. So my number nine movie is Fear Strikes Out, which came out in 1957. When I was looking for movies, I heard about this. I found it in some lists, and I saw Anthony Perkins was a star in it. Carl Malden's in it, too, who's very good. And I love Anthony Perkins. I think he's a phenomenal actor. So I was like, all right, cool. Let's see what this is about. And it was really, really good. It's about Jim Pearsall, who was a real ball player. Mm-hmm. Who struggled a lot with mental health issues. And I had never heard of him before this movie, to be honest. But he actually had a pretty great career. He had two All-Star appearances, two Gold Gloves, and finished top 10 for the MVP once. But this movie is mostly about Pearsall's struggles with his mental health and his upbringing, his entrance into the MLB, his relationship with his father, who was very emotionally withholding, and the movie kind of blames his father for his mental health issues a little more than I think it should, but overall, it's really well done. Anthony Perkins is fantastic. This is really early in his career. This is pre-Psycho. So you see him, and all you need to do, it's all in his face. Every great actor knows that your eyes are what show the most emotion. And if you look at Anthony Perkins' face throughout this, that's all you need to see. You look in his eyes, you see all the conflict, the irrational rage he feels during his outbursts in the movie, the emotional turmoil going on inside of him. It's all there, all in Perkins's face. He just does a really, really good job. It is a baseball movie, but in all honesty, it's more a drama about a son who desperately wants his father's approval and love and never actually gets it. And happens to be contextualized around baseball more than it is a baseball specific movie, but it's really well done. You see Pearsall's total mental breakdown, his admittance into a mental hospital, all of that. And it's crazy. It's especially impressive when you find out how well Pearsall's career went later. But it's really cool. It's a movie I had never heard of before, and I was really impressed with it.
Yeah, it's interesting. I pulled up his baseball reference page. He played from 50 to 67, quite the career.
Yep.
Played for like six or seven different teams. Obviously, the last 5 or 6 years, he didn't play over 100 games, but prior to that, at least 100 or more. He was a very good bat, like average asset, if we want to talk about it in those aspects of it. Decent power for those that era. So interesting little ball player. Like you said, he a couple All Stars, a couple MVP votes, Gold Gloves.
Yep.
Interesting.
Yep.
Very interesting.
And he struggled with bipolar disorder. And actually, so Fear Strikes Out, the movie, is based off of a book called Fear Strikes Out, which I believe Pearsall wrote. Pearsall would get into fights with teammates in 52 early on. He got into a fist fight with Billy Martin, one of the infielders on the Yankees, and then got in a fight with Mickey McDermott, Billy Martin on the Yankees. Pearsall was on the Red Sox. Then he got into a fight with Mickey McDermott, who was on the Red Sox with him in the clubhouse. He got in trouble for, I laugh just because it's wild, but it's actually not funny. He got into trouble for spanking one of his teammates' 4-year-old sons, which he had a lot of mental health issues, and mm-hmm. he would do kind of like wild, crazy things. One time he came up to bat wearing a Beatles wig and was playing air guitar on his bat. Just like he kind of leaned into it later in his career. He just was kind of like a goofy guy. He would lead cheers for himself. He would at Yankee Stadium, he would talk to the Babe Ruth monument in center field, like have a pretend conversation with it. He's
a goofball.
He was a unique, unique individual. But one of the things I really do love about the movie is that it does a pretty good job of tackling mental illness. It has a very sympathetic view towards mental illness, which is pretty impressive for 1957.
I was about to say, for 1957, yeah. That's like huge back then, because that's kind of one of those things they kind of mask or something like that. That's big.
Yeah. Well, they could have easily just dismissed Pierce. Oh, he's crazy. He's just a crazy guy. And they could have easily done that. And in 1957, you know, you probably wouldn't have blamed them. You know, obviously it's wrong, but at the same time, it's like, well, they didn't really know. But to have this sympathetic view towards mental illness was pretty impressive for a movie made in the late 50s. So it's good. It's worth watching.
It's pretty crazy. Made in 1957, we talked about his career. That was only like a seventh season. He still had 10 more years after that. Yeah. So that was only during his time in Boston. To make a movie and the guy still played 10 more years of baseball is pretty crazy to think about.
Yeah, exactly. It's a fascinating movie, and Jimmy Pearsall's a really interesting guy. So I would strongly recommend looking into Pearsall and checking out the movie.
Interesting. Very, very interesting. I'll have to put that one on my list as well. My number
and that
nine.
That one is streaming actually as well somewhere. I can find out pretty quickly.
I heard
if I remember correctly,
JustWatch.com is a good place to check.
Yes. Oh my gosh, JustWatch is the most fantastic place.
I still had it hanging on my notes from last episode right here.
Yeah, man. I am like a fierce proponent of that website. I think it was on Amazon Prime. I'm almost certain that Fear Strikes Out was on. Nope, it's on Pluto. It's on Pluto TV. Yeah, Pluto TV is this. It's all right. It's this free kind of quote unquote cable service. It's just an app where you can look up movies and watch them, and it has ads. So you have to deal with ads, but it is available for free on Pluto. So there's that, or you can buy it. Whatever you want to do.
Or buy it, yeah. My number nine, I thought I was done with my kids' movies, but I'm not. This is a little more of an adult kids' movie, if that makes sense. And this is the 1976, not the newer one, the 1976 version of The Bad News Bears. I love The Bad News Bears.
And I didn't include The Bad News Bears in my article, but I have some thoughts on it, so I'll be interested to hear what you say.
I'm looking forward to that, because and it's tough, because I'm only going to say the first one, because the ones that come after, I don't want to call them sequels, even though they are, but they're kind of all their different spinoffs of it. They're good in their own rights and they're bad in their own rights, kind of like Major League. But to me, I want to start with the one that started the whole thing, and The Bad News Bears. And Walter Matthau, to me, I thought was absolutely outstanding. I understand it's a weird dynamic to have this kind of, you know, former ball player. He's a drunk that doesn't want to be there. It's basically like the Mighty Ducks meets baseball for people like the Mighty Ducks, but this was made in 1976. But it's really fun because it's just this misfit group of ball players. Like, if you like the Little Rascals, it's basically like the Little Rascals found baseball. And that's what these guys are. You have, you know, the shortstop that can, you know, just wants to swear at everybody and get in fights. You have Kelly Leak riding it on his motorcycle, and he's just like the baddest player in baseball. Pretty much anybody that's played Little League before it gets, you know, maybe before AAA or the majors, before like the 9-10-year-old level, the early on stuff where kind of everybody's parents makes them play. It's like kids are out there that don't really want to be there, and that's kind of what this is. And then all of a sudden, Walter Matthau gets them playing well. He has to find them a sponsor, and it's Chico's Bail Bonds, for crying out loud. Like, there's a little league team with the back of their jersey says Chico's Bail Bonds. Like, that's just funny to me because that's something you wouldn't be able to make these days. You just couldn't make that kind of stuff. But I love it because it shows the kids a new way to like baseball. It changes Walter Matthau into a better human being. He becomes more like, you know, cleaned up and appreciates the kids. They kind of feed off each other and they fight together to win. It's basically, if you really want to get to the brass tacks of it, we're going to talk about it this week and next week. It's the kids' version of Major League. That's what this is. They put a bunch of ragtag kids together. They brought in this coach and they made this bad team a contender and a champion. I absolutely love it because the kids are fun. You can believe it if you played on some not – like for me, I think the other reason why I loved it, when I played Little League, my teams never won anything until All-Stars. Like my seasonal stuff, I never won a trophy ever. And my dad was our manager, and he always – we'd make fun of them because my brother's teams would win all the time, and he didn't manage them. So it was just one of those deals where it's a ragtag bunch that just had fun, and it resembled a lot of the Bad News Bears. So I love this movie from that respect. What were your thoughts on Bad News Bears?
So I'll start with what I like about it. It is a pretty enjoyable, very heartwarming, character-driven movie. And if there's one thing the movie does really, really well, it's establishing just about every single kid on the team as a character and making you care about them. Like every single, you know, every individual player on that team and you care about them for specific reasons. And that's not easy to do from a writing perspective. It is very easy, and I've seen so many movies do it, where you have an ensemble film that's about a group of characters, and the characters are just vehicles to move the plot forward. And Bad News Bears doesn't do that, and I appreciate that. And I also think Walter Matthau is fantastic in the movie. I think he plays his character... Good. Oh, he's so good. He plays his character so, so well. There are two problems I have with the movie. It really has not aged well at all.
No, it has not.
Not even a little bit. There's a lot of kids shouting racial slurs.
Oh, yeah, that's why I said you could not make this movie today.
Right.
There's no way you can make this movie today.
Nor should you have a movie where children are shouting racial slurs.
They're drinking in the dugout with Walter Matthau.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So there's that. There's also this really, really creepy way that they sexualize the character of Amanda.
True.
She's like, she's this 13-year-old girl, and throughout the whole movie, they are like very subtly sexualizing her. And it weirds me out. Like, it's, I don't know. There's a lot of comments about whether her breasts are developing in that movie. And
well, it gets
worse,
I think, in the next one when he kind of takes her under his wing and like goes shopping with her to get bras and stuff, I think.
Yeah, I mean, like, I can kind of get the whole, like, oh, you know, manly drunk man Walter Matthau having to, you know, have a surrogate daughter shop for bras or whatever. I can kind of get that. But just, I don't know, there's this really weird kind of just creepy feeling around this 13-year-old girl, and it's just, I don't know, it left me with a bad taste in my mouth. It felt weird. It's not overt, and nor do I necessarily think it's intentional. Mm-hmm. I don't really think it is. I think they're just kind of making jokes like, she's a girl, and you know, it's the 70s.
Yeah, it's 1976.
But yeah, yeah.
That's
yeah,
what
yeah.
It was. So
like, yeah, yeah. I mean, the whole, you know, she's a girl and she plays baseball. Mm-hmm. Like, that's kind of the whole thing. Whatever. But it just, I don't know, it felt creepy. It just felt really, really creepy to me. And just, it's just, there's some aspects to it where I'm watching it today and I'm like, I can put movies in the context of the time they were made. I believe that you should do that. I don't believe you can necessarily judge a movie made in 1937 by the moral standards of 2020, because it just isn't fair. You can acknowledge things that might be wrong with it. You can acknowledge that, you know, it's probably bad, or no, it's not probably. It's definitely bad that there's blackface in movies from the 20s. Mm-hmm. Like, that is a bad thing. But it's also important, I think, to understand the context of when the movie was made. I can do that with the Bad News Bears, but there's just, like I said, there's just some parts where I'm like, ooh, I don't love that. I don't love seeing the kids like shouting racial slurs at each other and stuff yeah, like that.
That's rough. It's rough.
Yeah. Yeah. So, but otherwise, outside of that stuff, it is a nice movie. And honestly, it was not far. It wasn't in my top 15, but it was not far outside. It was at, I want to say it was like number 17 on my list or something like that. So it just missed the cut. There are definitely things to like about it. There's definitely, it's not a movie I would watch with your kids.
No, no, not anymore. No. And that's the crazy thing is I watched it as a kid and like in the late 80s or early 90s, I watched it thinking no big deal, but how times have changed.
Well, you know, what's funny is like, I don't know. It's weird. Movies in the 60s and 70s were, I mean, there were all kinds of controversies over ratings because of sexual content or things like that, that today we're like, oh, really? People were worried about, you know, Midnight Cowboy got an X rating because it was about a male prostitute. Really? Yeah. So there's that. But at the same time, there's like kids movies from the 70s where you're like, oh no, I would not show that to a child.
This like, was PG.
Yeah, PG. Now, I don't know if this was around before PG-13.
True. Existed. I don't know. It's a good point.
You know the movie that started PG-13?
No. What was it?
Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom, which was 1984. Really? Yes.
Wow. Surprising.
Wait, Temple of Doom's... Yeah, Temple of Doom's number two. Yes.
Yeah.
Yep. Wow. Yeah, so it used to be they had G, PG, R, and X.
X. Okay.
And that's why Airplane is rated PG, or it was.
Oh my goodness, that should be rated
right.
R.
Right. Well, yeah. I mean, there's nudity in it. I mean, yeah,
nudity, swearing, but drugs, everything.
Absolutely, absolutely. But at the time, it was PG, and so what happened was it was G PG just meant hey, your parents should come to this, and you know it's up to the parents. And R was adults only, and then X was beyond that, and then the porn industry kind of co-opted the X rating and they had to change it to NC-17. But when Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom came out, it was kind of this like, I don't know, this is a little violent for PG, but it's not quite R. And so after that, Indiana Jones and the Temple of Doom was rated PG, but after that PG-13 came around. So I would imagine had Bad News Bears been made post PG-13, it would have been rated PG-13.
Yeah, no doubt about that. But one thing I want to mention one last time is you mentioned Walter Matthau, and so did I. He's such a great actor, and movies like Grumpy Old Men, Grumpier Old Men. There's things from Walter Matthau was in. The overall movie might be bad, but what he can do in a movie, it's just he's so funny and it's so easy to him. It's crazy.
Speaking of movies that you should not let children watch, my grandmother for some reason thought it was okay for me to watch Grumpy Old Men when I was like
probably a bad idea.
I swear I was like seven. I think I was seven or eight. I was over at my grandmother's house and she had these random VHSs and she was like, "Ah, you want to watch a movie?" I'm like, "Yeah, sure." She's like, "Here, take this one." It was Grumpy Old Men. And I watched it and I was like, "Oh, I shouldn't be watching this." And especially like I said last podcast, I grew up in a very strict movie household. Mm-hmm. And my grandmother just didn't know what was in it. She was going to, I didn't end up watching it, but she handed me, like the next time I was over, she handed me When Harry Met Sally.
Oh my. That would have been something for you.
I was literally like between 7 and 9 years old. Like that. And
that would have been educational.
She was like, "Hey, I got this." And I never watched. I don't remember why I didn't watch it. It just like, it wasn't because I was, you know, I was like, "Grandma, I shouldn't watch this." But it was more like I just ran out of time or something. And then I told my parents, like, "Yeah, grandma's going to have me watch this movie, When Harry Met Sally." And my dad was like, "Oh, we should talk to grandma."
Yeah, we need to let her know. It's probably a bad idea.
Right, exactly.
Did you ever watch the remake of Bad News Bears with Billy Bob Thornton that I thought?
I have a funny story about that. So as I said last podcast, I grew up very religious. And when I was in... I guess that came out in 05. I think it was 05. So I would have been 14 or 15, depending. 14 probably when that came out. Yeah, because it came out in the summer. I went on a missions trip with my grandparents' church to South Dakota. And we had a day where it was like, "Hey, we're going to go to the Mall of America." We went to Minnesota at some point. We were in South Dakota for the mission trip. Ended up in Minnesota just basically to go to the Mall of America. And while we were there, everybody decided, hey, we're going to go see a movie. Let's go to the movie theater. And Bad News Bears was out, the remake. So these two random people who I vaguely knew from this missions trip took me, and who I was 14, and my brother, who was 10, to go see Bad News Bears. And they start it, and Billy Bob Thornton is cursing up a storm, as you would kind of expect. And they got up and said, we are leaving. Like 20 minutes into the movie, they said, we're out of here. We're leaving this movie. That is, to this day, the only movie I've ever walked out of.
And see, Bad News Bears, I pulled it up. The 76 was a 7.3 stars on IMDb. The Billy Bob was a 5.8, and it was PG-13.
Yeah, it was PG-13. I don't know why they thought, oh, you know, it'll be fine. It's just PG-13. My guess is they saw, oh, Bad News Bears. I remember when that movie came out. This will be fine for the kids, and didn't look at the rating. They brought us in there, and it's like these church people, and they're like, oh, like they're clutching their pearls, and like, Billy Bob Thornton is saying so many bad words. And then they took us out, and we instead of just leaving and doing something else, we walked into a different movie. Like, we didn't buy tickets. We walked in to see Sky High, and we started Sky High about 15 minutes into the movie, and that's what we watched. But to this day, the only movie I have ever walked out of was Bad News Bears, the remake, and that was involuntarily.
Well, that's a story for you. All right, enough on Bad News Bears. That was fun. Let's go to your number 8. I mentioned it last episode as one that I saw on a ton of lists that I need to check out, because I'd never heard of it until I started researching for this, and it seems pretty darn popular. So explain to us why Sugar is your number 8.
Sugar is so good. Yeah, so Sugar, that was another one where I saw it on a bunch of lists, and I was like, I've never heard of this. Came out in 2008. It didn't get a whole ton of publicity, and I think that's the problem. More than anything, this movie is a character study that asks a really, really interesting question, which is, what happens when you've spent your entire life pursuing playing professional baseball as your family's way out of poverty? We talked last time about Pelotero, the documentary about the international scouting, and how so many international players, Dominican players and all, they rely on getting signed by a major league team as their family's ticket out of poverty. They focus their whole lives on playing baseball, and they're hoping to get that, you know, $5 million bonus to go play in the majors. So Sugar talks about those players in a fictional narrative, and it asks, when you spend your whole life trying to play professional baseball as your family's ticket out of poverty, only to just end up as a very good player, but not very good, but not good enough minor leaguer, what do you do? Because you're stuck in the minor. You got that bonus, which is great, but as we all know, minor leaguers don't make a whole lot. And if you are a quadruple A player, where you're just kind of wasting away in triple A, and all you know is baseball. Baseball is the singular pursuit of your life. What do you do? And that's what this movie talks about. This, the main character is a guy named Miguel Santos, who's a really, really good pitcher, starts succeeding really well in the minor leagues, starts faltering, breaks down. I would say, the film doesn't say this explicitly, but I would personally say that one of the reasons he breaks down is because he and all of the other players are basically just treated as machines. They're not treated as people. They're just kind of tools that are meant to be refined. And if they don't work out, then they're just kind of tossed aside. They're not people. It's just business. There's an argument to be made for, like, hey, that's kind of how baseball has to work. I think Moneyball made that argument pretty decently, but that's beside the point. As a result of his breakdown and his inability to get out of the minors, Miguel starts losing the family he develops on his team. You know, it's another aspect of the film I think that's interesting, is you start developing these friendships with guys on minor league teams, and they get promoted or demoted, and they're gone, and you can't really build a relationship with these guys because they're gone, and you have to build brand new relationships. Or maybe you get promoted or demoted, and there's a whole lot of fluidity to it. And so it kind of takes all of that, the singular pursuit of baseball as a foreign player, the way Major League Baseball treats players as assets instead of people sometimes, and the inability to kind of establish familial relationships with teams because of the fluidity of minor leagues. And it says, how does all of that affect the mental headspace of an individual player? And that's, and it's a really, really fascinating story. You start seeing Santos go through this like existential crisis where he's like, should I be playing baseball? Should I even be bothering with this? If I'm not going to make it to the major leagues, if I'm going to keep struggling, why am I bothering? Should I just go somewhere else and do something else? Have I been wasting my entire life just trying to pursue this thing that I'm just not that good at or not good enough at? So it's really interesting. I won't give away the whole movie, but it is a fascinating character study on Miguel Santos. The person who plays Santos, Alginis Perez Soto, just kills it. I mean, does such a good job. It is directed by Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck, who do a fantastic job with the direction. There's some really nice shots. It's really well done. It is a criminally underrated movie, in my opinion. It's absolutely worth seeing. It's another one of those movies, like I said, about Fear Strikes Out, where it is a baseball movie. It's a drama in the context of baseball. And this is another one of those where it's a kind of existential character study in the context of baseball. And by the way, Anna Boden and Ryan Fleck later went on to direct Captain Marvel. So you may know them from that.
Mm-hmm.
And also It's Kind of a Funny Story, which was around 2010. So they're a good writing team, they're a good directing team. So yeah, absolutely. Go see Sugar. It is a wonderful movie.
I like the concept of it. It's basically, like you said, a case study on it. We talk about minor leaguers and, a lot of the talk about pay for minor leaguers and all these different things. And you watch how they, even on right now, with what we're going through with the virus and baseball on hold, and you see, that they're raising, Emily Walden's raising money for minor leaguers and all this awesome stuff, because they're always going through a different kind of world than a lot of people think of when they just think baseball player. And so you're talking about kind of the way he's watching guys go up and down, what's going on in his head as he's making his way through, not making a ton of money, all these different things. It's an interesting dynamic there, because like we'll talk about Bull Durham and other movies, when you see the kind of the minor league aspect of things, the life that they live, it's totally different than the bigs that we obviously know. So that's an interesting concept to kind of show the baseball side of it, but also the deep personal nature and development, I guess you could say, of the actual person. So pretty cool stuff.
Check that out. It's really cool to see that, because honestly, for me at least, it was something I never really thought about. Like when I think about the minor leagues, I think about just because, I play fantasy, I think about top prospects and, guys who are coming up for teams, that are going to have a major league impact. You don't think about every single minor league team from low A, high A, double and triple A. Every single team has a full team. And not every single one of those players is going to the majors. Not every single one of those players is ever going to touch the majors. So it's kind of an interesting study of the forgotten players of minor league baseball with an added perspective of the international players. Mm-hmm. So it's both of those into one. So it's a fascinating movie. It's really well done. Horribly, horribly underrated. So strongly recommend seeing it.
I'll have to check it out. My number eight, we don't have to talk about, because we talked about it last episode, is The Natural. And the more you talked about it, you started making me kind of double, like think things through. So I'm like, yeah, you got some points there. You got some more points there. Like the whole Roy Hobbs aspect of playing baseball reminds me of Kirk Gibson and all that's pretty fun. but and just kind of his storyline there. But then when you mention, you know, why is she a murderer and all these other things, I'm like, yeah, that makes sense for a pretty rough movie. So mine's a natural. We talked about it a ton.
It's just the writing. It's the cinematography, the way it's filmed, the acting is all excellent. It's actually an enjoyable movie. It's just there's a lot of suspension of disbelief that made me go like, what is happening in this movie? This is wild.
Yeah, it makes a lot of sense when you said it. So, yeah, The Natural, if you guys are curious on our deep dive on that, we talked about it quite a bit on the last episode, so go check that out. Your number seven, we actually talked about as well. So what is it?
Yes, we did. Number seven, 61. We already kind of jumped into that. So, again, like I said about Sugar, 61, terribly underrated. Go see it. It's on. That one's easy. Sugar's a little harder to see. You're going to have to buy that one probably or find it somewhere else. I'm not sure where you can find it, honestly. 61 is on HBO, I'm almost certain.
Yes, it's got to be. Yeah.
Yeah, it has to be. So you can pretty easily see that if you've got HBO. So definitely go see that.
All right, my number seven, and it's in your top five, and I've literally, from seven on up, I can make arguments to move all kinds of things around, and I just stuck with this seven. This one kills me and pains me to have here. I actually had Chris Towers on my last episode yesterday, and this is his number one baseball movie, and I can't argue that. Like, I really, wherever anybody ranks this, I get. My number seven is The Sandlot.
Oh, boy.
I love The Sandlot. I just have some of these other ones going a little higher. I believe it's in your top five. No.
It is. The Sandlot is very much not in my top five.
Oh, outstanding. So
I
not even
very
ranked.
Much do not like The Sandlot. In fact, it is a running joke at PitcherList among the staff writers when we start talking about baseball movies that I don't like The Sandlot. So go ahead. You do your thing, yes. And yeah, we'll talk about it.
It's going to be fun. So what I love about it is, and I think we talked about this before, some of the things you don't like about it, which I don't disagree with. But what I do love is it's, you know, kids. It reminds me of playing like pickup ball, like we kind of talked about some other movies. It's in a weird era. The kid moves to town, doesn't have any friends. And what brings him together? Baseball, the beautiful game of baseball. Doesn't know who Babe Ruth is, steals his dad's baseball. They play with it. Obviously, he loses it to the dog. The whole story is there, but you got Benny the Jet, who was a great player. Like every group of friends that played ball always had one guy that was like so much better, and you always dreamed of playing in the majors someday. And then Benny the Jet's obviously there. The kid from out of town that moves in, Smalls, he becomes the broadcaster for the Dodgers. That's always fun. But the actual game, you have the clubhouse or the fort, I guess. They stay overnight. You got, Wendy Peppercorn watching them at the pool. You got the catcher. You have all the different characters. They go deep diving into so many of them, and they're all different in their own right. And I absolutely loved it. It's just, you know, get done with school. Let's go play ball. Let's all save our money, recycle canes to get another baseball at the drugstore. And just, you know, they basically lived it out. They actually played a couple games against, I guess, neighboring teams. It was just a cool concept that I really, really liked. It's a total childhood kind of throwback to playing whenever, wherever you could go play a game of baseball. So I love The Sandlot. Again, it's my seven, though. Like I said, I've heard other people have it really high, but you don't even have it in your top 15. So why don't you tell me why you do not like The Sandlot?
Yeah, so of all the articles I have ever written on PitcherList, this article, my top 15 baseball movies, and also three movies I really don't like, got the most interaction I've ever gotten from readers. It has like 30 comments, which is nuts for pretty much any PitcherList article. It got so much hate because mostly of me saying I don't like The Sandlot, and I knew that would happen. And I have, it's kind of the joke about me not liking The Sandlot among the PitcherList writers has kind of evolved into this weird thing where I supposedly just hate The Sandlot with every fiber of my body. And I don't. But I have a theory about it. How old were you when you saw The Sandlot?
The first time. Let's see. It came out in 93. So yep. I was probably 11 or 12.
Exactly. So I believe, let me contextualize this. People who grew up in the 90s, who kind of came of age in the 90s and the early 2000s, millennials and later Gen X, have a strong attachment to 90s nostalgia.
No doubt about it. That's why absolutely. I like those other movies last time. Like, it's just absolutely. Something about growing up with them.
And I think there's a good reason for it. If you think about it, those of us who came of age in the 90s and the early 2000s, we experienced so much technological change mm-hmm. in such a short period of time that the technology, the world of, say, 1998 feels like 40 years ago. You think about the telephone. How much did the telephone change between 1960 and 1970, or 1970 and 1980? Not a ton. You had landlines, you know, maybe party lines go away, but in general, the telephone didn't change. How much did the telephone change between 2000 and 2010?
Quite a bit.
It went from a landline phone, or perhaps a relatively large cell phone,
yep,
to a supercomputer that has access to the entire sum of human knowledge in your pocket.
Yep.
Like, that is
quite the jump.
Exponential astronomical change. That's just phones. That's not even talking about the internet, how much computers have changed, how much listening to music has changed. Just so much change happened between, say, 1990, 1995, and the late 2000s. So it is perfectly understandable why people my age and a little bit older are so nostalgic for the 90s, because it just, they have whiplash from all the change that happened. And I get it. I think The Sandlot is part of that. A little bit. The Sandlot is a perfectly fine kids movie. Yes. It's, if there's one thing I like about The Sandlot, and one thing I appreciate about it has a lot of heart. I genuinely think that David Mickey Evans loves baseball, and he put his entire heart into this movie. And you get that. You feel that when you watch the movie. It wasn't some studio that came together and was like, what if we did The Goonies, but instead of treasure hunting, it was baseball? That's not what happened. What happened was David Mickey Evans loves baseball, and he made a movie about how much he loves baseball. And when you are an 8-year-old, 9-year-old, 10-year-old kid who loves playing baseball, you connect with that movie so much, and I totally get it. I saw The Sandlot for the first time when I was 18.
Yeah, it's a little different.
And,
okay.
Yeah. And when I saw it on a bus trip to a to Florida, mm-hmm. and I was in marching band because I was super cool and all the ladies loved me.
What instrument did you play?
I mean, it was the clarinet. Which, here's the thing, I played clarinet for a long time, and playing clarinet in marching band is the most useless thing you could possibly play. There is no more useless instrument
in marching band. All the noises out of a marching band get kind of they overshadow the clarinet.
Marching band is about the brass, which is real loud and powerful. You can hear the saxophones a lot of times, especially if they get a solo, they can get a groove going, especially like the Barry sax is real deep. You know, you're playing Hang On Sloopy and the Barry sax is great. Flutes and piccolos, very marching band like. Drumline, of course, that's like the heart of marching band. Even the pit, a little bit, xylophones and stuff. Clarinet, nothing. Absolutely nothing. You cannot hear the clarinet. You can pantomime, and I did that sometimes. You could pantomime all of your playing clarinet. You are entirely useless. You are the appendix of the marching band body. You can just be completely taken out and nothing bad will happen to the rest of the band. But you still have to learn all the steps. You still have to learn all the music. You have to memorize the music because, God forbid, you have the music on your clarinet. So, yeah. Anyways, I remember.
I love it.
Sorry,
I love it.
I'm going to go on a really brief marching band tangent. I remember my senior year of high school, we got a new band director at my high school. And my high school required you to be in marching band if you wanted to be in concert band. probably because they knew that nobody wanted to be in marching band. And we were in, we had a new band director, and this new band director decided that the marching band, the members of the marching band needed to be more athletic. They needed to run laps and things like that. And I remember sitting down with him and saying, look, if we were more athletic, we would not be in band. We would be playing sports. We would not be doing something that primarily requires you to sit still. Mm-hmm. And we are all in marching band because we have to be. We should not be running a mile before every marching band rehearsal. That's just not what... I mean, you see, it was so sad. You see these kids, these like overweight kids who just wanted to play in band. They just wanted to play the tuba. And they're like wheezing and about to pass out, circling the tech building for the fourth time. And you're just like, why are you doing this to us? It was ridiculous. I was never a fan of marching band. I like good marching bands, like watching them. Never a fan of participating in it. But on a marching band trip to Florida, I watched Sandlot for the first time. I was 18. And I had heard so much about it. I love baseball. I was like, sweet. I finally get to see this classic baseball movie. And I came away from it going, okay, like, it was fine. It's not a terrible movie. It's not super great. I don't think it's particularly well acted. It's a little overly nostalgic about the 60s. But I understand, and I think it's okay. If you like The Sandlot, I think it's perfectly okay. It is... The beauty of film, the beauty of all art, is that people will have a deep, personal, meaningful connection to different forms of art for their own reasons, and that's awesome. Like if you saw a Face Off and it just changed your life, great. I'm so happy that Face Off changed your life. If you think, look, Bill and Ted's Bogus Journey is so much better than Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. Great, you're wrong, but that's fine. That's totally fine. It's okay, but the thing that bothers me is when The Sandlot is touted as this cinematic masterpiece.
Yeah, it's not. I'll admit that.
It was named by Bleacher Report as the second best sports movie of all time.
Yeah, no.
Ever.
No.
Behind only Raging Bull.
Yeah, that's horrible. But yeah, like, that is great.
No, that's nuts. If you personally love Sandlot, great. If you're going to sit there and tell me, oh, no, like this is a better written, better acted, better made movie than Field of Dreams, A League of Their Own, Major League, stuff like that. I'm like, come on. Like, we tend to take 90s nostalgia and we amplify it. And we take these movies and we're like, yeah, this is the greatest thing ever. You know, this, whatever this was, Oreo O's, the greatest cereal ever. And it's like, you just have a really good memory eating Oreo O's. It doesn't mean that they were the greatest cereal ever. So it's just that's my thing with The Sandlot. I think it is perfectly fine that people love it. But when you start talking about it as the greatest baseball movie of all time or the greatest sports movie of all time, I'm like, okay, let's scale it back a little bit. That is no disrespect to Chris. If Chris loves this as his favorite baseball movie of all time, I respect Chris's opinion on movies and music, especially music. Mm-hmm. And I'm sure he's got a great reason for it. And if he has a deep personal connection with The Sandlot, good for him. That's awesome. We can disagree on that, but it just, I think it's because I saw it as an adult or a young adult that I didn't connect with it.
Well, no, and I agree with you. Like, I think the nostalgia is huge. It's a huge factor. It's like when we get to the next, you know, five or six, these are some movies I could watch pretty much any time. Like these ones down below, there's a lot of nostalgia there. The Sandlot, one of them.
Sure.
It was actually funny. Rookie of the Year, Little Big League, we talked about. I actually got in the debate on Twitter today about those two movies, and it actually came down to nostalgia. Like one guy said, he thought Rookie of the Year was horrible, and he watched it when he was older. I said, I get it. If I watched Rookie of the Year or Little Big League when I was older, I'd probably be, this movie's really not that good. Like, I totally understand it.
Totally,
it's just one
fine.
Of those things. Yeah, one of those things when you watch it, it's stuck in your craw. If you want to like Sandlot as one of the better baseball movies, no problem. If you want to get into the better sports movies, we're going to have a conversation. Like that's tricky.
And that happens. That totally happens. And that's okay. That's the beauty of art. It's like my feelings about Small Soldiers. Small Soldiers is not a good movie, but for some stupid reason as a child, I latched onto Small Soldiers so hard. And I had all the toys. I had a novelization of the film for some dumb reason. I don't know. But as like a 8, 9, 10 year old, however old I was when Small Soldiers came out, I really latched on to Small Soldiers. It is not that good of a movie, but for some reason I loved it. Yep. So it happens, and that's totally, totally okay. Also, totally just side note on the Sandlot, not really a problem, but I mentioned this in the last time we talked about Sandlot, but one of the things that kind of slightly bothered me when I was watching it is like this movie takes place in California in 1962, and all these kids are obsessed with Babe Ruth a year after Roger Maris broke the home run record.
That's like, valid. Very valid.
Come on. Yeah. Like, really? The Dodgers are in California. Like, it's not that long after they came to L.A. Yep. You got a whole group of kids who are like, yeah, but Babe Ruth, like, I don't know.
Yeah. You got the Dodgers in L.A., the Giants just came to California also. Willie Mays, like, their rivalry is there. There's probably a lot of angles you could go with for sure.
Yeah, no doubt about that. Babe Ruth, like, okay.
Yeah, I'm with you there. I'm going to say my sixth real quick. So you talked about last episode and Eight Men Out, which I absolutely love. Like, I'm a big fan of the historical aspect of it.
Good movie.
And we both really liked it, and we kind of agree that they just need to develop it a little more. And it would have been much better.
That, yeah.
So Eight Men Out.
Fantastic cast and good movie.
Yes. Amazing cast. So Eight Men Out's my sixth. But I wanted to say that first because the last movie we're going to talk about tonight, and I cannot wait because I agree with every time you say it, that the beauty of art is we all can have our own opinion. We're going to talk about this movie again next week, but I want to know why or what made Major League your sixth movie.
I love Major League. It's so much fun, and it's so funny and just so well done. It is so easy to watch. Like, it is a movie you can just some movies you feel their runtime. You do not feel the runtime of Major League. It just blows by. It's well paced. It's fun. Similar to what I said about Bad News Bears, this is an ensemble movie with a bunch of characters, and the movie takes the time to make you care about every single character. It establishes every character, and you care about them. You know who Ricky Vaughn is. You know his story. You know who Pedro Serrano is. You know his story. Tom Berenger's character, you know all of them, and you care about them. And that is a sign of very good writing. Because, like I said, a lot of times group ensemble characters can just be just vehicles for a plot to happen. So that is one of the things I love about Major League. But one of the things I love the most about Major League, outside of quick tangent, Bob Uecker is incredible.
Amazing. Just absolutely amazing. For a guy that's not on the field, steals the show.
Just an absolute joy. Bob Uecker is such a delight. He is such a treasure. And he makes Major League 2 so much more bearable.
Yeah, but I was about to say, he makes it watchable. Yes, he definitely does.
Bob Uecker is just a gift. But aside from that, probably the thing I really, really appreciate the most about Major League is the final game in Major League. The way they do it so well. A lot of baseball movies, a lot of sports movies can rush a major climactic game. Understandably, from a filmmaking perspective, your audience has been waiting and waiting and waiting for 80 minutes, 70 minutes for this payoff. And you want to give it to them. And I can understand the temptation of wanting to give them the payoff quickly. They're sitting there like, it's been an hour and 20 minutes. Come on. You know, I want to feel happy about this team winning or something. But Major League does not do that. They know, the movie knows what makes baseball great. And what makes baseball great is the suspense. There is so much suspense in baseball. One of my favorite quotes when I try to explain to people why I love baseball, I always reference this quote from Earl Weaver, where he said, and I'm paraphrasing, the beauty of baseball is that you cannot run out the clock. You can't be up by a certain amount of points and make it impossible for the other team to come back. You can't just, you know, sit on the ball and let the clock run down and that's it. You have to give the other team a shot. And no matter what. And this movie understands that. This movie understands that there's so much suspense in baseball. And it drags out in a good way, not in a painful way. It drags out the major climactic game. And it drags out is a poor phrase. It takes its time. It's deliberate. And because it does that, the payoff is so great. Yep. It is so worth it. It is so hard not to feel a little emotional and just be so happy at the end of the film because of the way they pace it. It is, I firmly believe it is because they pace it so well. You spend a large amount of this movie becoming very invested in all of these characters, and then to see the payoff and to see the payoff paced well is just, it's so good. It's so wonderful. All the performances are awesome. The cast, I genuinely do not know that the cast could be better.
No, I don't think it could. I think they did it perfectly.
They casted it perfectly. Dennis Haysbert as Pedro Serrano is amazing. Charlie Sheen as Ricky Vaughn is amazing.
Perfect. Absolutely. He aged in that one really well, if you think about it.
Yeah,
the California Penal League till now, real well.
Right, exactly. Wesley Snipes?
Yes, Willie Mays. Like,
oh my gosh, Wesley Snipes is so good.
James Gammon as Lou Brown. I couldn't picture a different Lou Brown after they did that.
Exactly. Oh my gosh, right. Exactly. And it just, you really feel, even when you watch Major League 2, you really feel the absence of Wesley Snipes there.
Yes.
Like,
yes.
Credit to Omar Epps. I think Omar Epps is a very good actor. Yep. And he does his best Wesley Snipes doing Willie Mays Hayes impression. But you really feel the absence there. And when Wesley Snipes was really, really good in Major League.
He was outstanding in Major League.
It was so good. Also, there's a fun little Neil Flynn, who played the janitor in Scrubs. He pops up at the end as a longshoreman, which is kind of fun to see. But I love Major League. I am sad that Major League 2 exists, and even sadder that Major League 3 exists.
Well, we'll talk about Major League 3, I think, maybe down the line, because you guys have an article at Pitcher List. And
yes.
I will give my 2 cents on Major League next week. I'll save my deeper dive in it since it's up in mine. But the thing I wanted to mention that I think when you said Major League 2, as much as we loved things about Major League 1, the storytelling and all these things, correct me if I'm wrong, but it feels like Major League 2, the thing we loved about Major League 1 is all the different characters. Major League 2, they tried to narrow it down to like Sheen and Omar Epps.
Right.
And then it's almost like the good part about the movie now, it's Bob Uecker still gold in it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
And they make the fans that are, you know, the guy that changed his loyalty. That's almost a bigger story than the actual movie itself.
That was, what's his name, Randy Quaid.
Yes, Randy Quaid.
Randy Quaid. Yeah, I know.
It feels like that's more of the show, and it's just like, oh, come on,
guys. It's also a total carbon copy of Major League.
Yes.
Like, they even bring back the same villain.
I think they had the same music in the final game, but
probably.
It's like I can picture it in my head. I think it's the same.
The only difference to Major League 2 is one, it was filmed in Camden Yards, which is actually kind of cool. Like for me, as an Orioles fan, it was kind of neat to see, like, oh, cool, Camden Yards. Like, look at that. That was really cool. But the only difference between Major League and Major League 2 is they have this super racist Asian character.
Yeah, out of nowhere. Let's bring let's bring the Okie catcher that can only read Playboy to throw to the pitcher. Like,
right.
Because redneck Okies are so dumb, they can't figure it out.
Nobody ever thought to tell that catcher, like, hey, maybe catcher's not your position.
Yeah.
They're in the American League. He could DH. Like,
So this
is the Indians. They're in the American League. The DH is an option.
Right? And it's not like he was a great offensive talent. So I'm not sure why they were rushing this prospect to the bigs.
I don't know. It was just, Major League 2 wasn't great. I haven't seen Major League 3, but yes, our own Dave Fisher wrote an article. He's been looking at the worst baseball movies of all time. And he takes a look at Major League 3, Back to the Minors, which features the ever-talented Scott Bakula.
Yes. Always dreamy hair, ever-talented.
Oh, yeah. And the hair is dreamy in Back to the Minors. I've seen bits of it, but I've never seen the full movie.
Okay, you talk about, we talk about how the casting was so great in 8 Men Out, so great in Major League. They looked like ballplayers. Scott Bakula, when he puts a jersey on, does not look like a ballplayer at all.
There's a scene, and I only know this from reading Dave's article because I actually haven't seen the movie. But there's a scene where, like, there's an emphasis on his hair is real.
That's been like, so long. Okay, here's the deal. Once we finish however many more episodes we have of this list, because we might slow it down with those last five, I think we need to have your writer at Pitcher List. What was his name again? Sorry?
Dave Fisher.
You need to watch it, and we might have to have a Major League 3 episode to just clown on it.
You're going to make me watch Major League Back to the Minors, and I'm going to hate it. Oh, my gosh. Yeah, I should do it. I hate going into a movie knowing that it's going to be bad. Yeah. I don't know what's worse. Going into a movie knowing it's going to be bad or going into a movie thinking it's going to be good and realizing it's bad.
Thinking it's going to be good and it turns out to be bad's worse.
I think you're right. I recently watched, since I've been quarantined at home, I'm trying to go through the IMDb top 250. I've got about roughly 70 movies left. I'm not going to finish it in quarantine time, but I also have just been going through my own watch list, and I had Howard Hughes's The Outlaw on my watch list, which is a Billy the Kid Western movie. Mm-hmm. And I was like, oh, cool. This sounds cool. And it was bad. Like, it was not very good. And that was really disappointing. Like, I'm sitting there like an hour into this movie going, okay, when's this going to end? Like, I do not like this. So I think you're right. I think thinking a movie will be good and finding out it's bad is worse. Because I went into Major League 2 going, this is not going to be good. Like, I had hoped it would be okay and it was actually bad. But I did not go into Major League 2 thinking this is going to be as good as Major League. So maybe to the Minors won't be that hard to watch.
Honestly, I can't wait till you watch it, actually, because I can listen to an argument where it's at least better than Major League 2.
Really? Oh, my.
Okay. I'm not going to completely say it is, but I wouldn't be opposed to someone fighting that argument. Let's put it that way.
I mean, at least Bob Uecker is still in Major League 3.
Yeah, and at least it's more of a different cast, because once Charlie Sheen went, class, like all these different guys changed the things we loved about them, it kind of took the luster out of the film.
Interesting. Yeah, no, we'll have to, all right, so what we'll have to do is I'll have to watch Back to the Minors. I won't do it yet. And when I do, I'll write down I always write down everything. Every movie I watch, I write a review of it because I will forget what I thought about the movie later. But, oh, man, Back to the Minors is not streaming anywhere. I'll have to find it somewhere else. Corbin Burnson's in it again as Roger Dorn.
I think he's the owner of the franchise.
And Dennis Haysbert's back as Pedro Serrano. My God. That poor guy.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, yeah. Walton Goggins is in it.
Yes. Oh, he's actually, it's one of his early, earlier films. Let's put it that way.
Oh, man. Baby Billy.
Baby Billy.
Do you watch The Righteous Gemstones?
I love The Righteous Gemstones. I love Danny McBride.
I love Danny McBride. Thank you. Yes.
Anything he's in, I will watch because A, I have a big sense of humor, and B, I can do the dirty, the non-dirty. I have a sense of humor. And I think he's just brilliant. He's absolutely brilliant at what he does.
He's so good. Did you see This Is the End?
Yes. Came out a couple years ago.
It was a few years back, but the apocalypse movie with all the celebrities starring.
With Seth Rogen and stuff. Yeah, he had
Seth Rogen and Danny McBride is so hilarious. Good in that. Yes. He is brilliant in that. But yeah, yeah, I'll have to watch Back to the Miners, and we'll have to have Dave on. And God, it's got a 21% on Rotten Tomatoes.
I'm just telling you, I think it'll be a fun discussion just to kind
of. Yeah, probably really... will be. And then I'll get, Dave said he promises he's going to do an article on Trouble with the Curve, which I
see.
Hate.
I've never seen that. I've never seen it. God, so I'll watch that. There's the deal.
So bad.
There's the deal. You watch the Miners, I'll watch Trouble with the Curve.
And we'll do a whole movie ranting about how much we hate him. Actually, wow. You know what? Movies. You know what? You might be right. Major League 2 has a 5% on Rotten Tomatoes.
And I was just pulling that off the top of my head, like thinking about it.
Back to the Miners has a like a 50-some percent. So you might be absolutely right. 21%. I'm sorry. 21% for Back to the Miners, 5% for Major League 2. So you might be right.
Oh, this is going to be fun. This is going to be great. Oh, but any final thoughts on our 6 through 10 before we just go down a deep rabbit hole here?
No, I'm curious though. So one of the of all the comments I got, there were a lot of comments I got where they were saying, I can't believe you did not include For the Love of the Game. Do you have the Love of the Game in your top five?
Nope.
Okay. Well then
it's not a baseball movie to me. Like you the baseball part's cool and all, but it's a gigantic love story.
It is, right? And it is so long. Yes. That is
way too
long.
Way too long.
I don't have a problem with long movies.
No, not if they're done well.
Not if they're done well. Like one of my favorite movies of all time is Once Upon a Time in America, and it's almost 4 hours long. It's got an intermission in it. Yeah. If a long movie is done well, that's fine. But For the Love of the Game, it's what, 2.5 hours?
If I'm having to check my phone to know what time it is because I'm wondering when this movie's over, that's bad.
Yes, absolutely. I will say this. The baseball parts, I just want to address For the Love of the Game for all the people who are like, I can't believe you don't have For the Love of the Game. Actually, two movies, and I'll be brief about them. For all the people who are like, I can't believe you don't have For the Love of the Game in your list, I like the baseball parts For the Love of the Game.
Yeah, Billy Chappell, he can fling it.
Absolutely. I love baseball movies in general, and I love the baseball parts of this, but I found myself so often saying, God, just stop it with the boring romance and get back to the baseball.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I love, as we'll explore in the next episode, I love a baseball movie that explores life outside of baseball, like Bull Durham.
Bull Durham. They don't like go so deep in it that it just consumes you.
Right. Well, I mean, the romance in For the Love of the Game is about as compelling as a Lifetime movie. Like,
that's true.
It really is.
Know what's going to happen. You already know what's going to happen. Like, it's too obvious.
Part of the problem is Kelly Preston.
Yeah.
Like, she just does her best discount Meg Ryan in this movie.
That's so good.
It's so bad. There's a scene in the hospital where she yells at, I don't remember, it was a doctor. She goes, is this not America? Like, I'm just like, what are you doing? Like, I don't know. Kevin Costner does fine. And I, you know, honestly, if there's one thing to love about For the Love of the Game, John C. Reilly is great.
I was about to say, John C. Reilly as a catcher, I never would have thought in a million years.
I want it to be known that John C. Reilly is one of the greatest character actors who has ever lived. I truly, truly believe that. He gets roped in with all of the goofy Will Ferrell stuff he does and the comedies, and he's great at that. But he is a phenomenal character actor. Absolutely phenomenal character actor. And he plays the best friend catcher so well. Like, I want him to be my best friend in that movie. He does it so well. And also, Vin Scully is incredible in this movie.
Yes.
Vin Scully is a treasure. Just like Bob Uecker is a treasure, Vin Scully is an absolute treasure. And he is far and away the best part of the movie. The baseball parts of this movie are so good. But the rest of the movie is just, the romance part is so dragged out and generic and just uninteresting.
Yep.
But the last movie I want to briefly address, because I got a lot of comments about it and people were like, why didn't you have this, is 42.
I almost had that, but I don't have that either.
Yeah. So 42, and I'd be curious what you think about it. So, have you ever seen the Jackie Robinson Story, the movie, the Jackie Robinson Story?
Much better than 42.
Actually, I'll be honest. I liked 42 better than the Jackie Robinson story. The Jackie Robinson story, Jackie Robinson is in it, and he is just, he's just not a very good actor. I mean, he's a baseball player, and he just doesn't do a great job. But it's kind of cool to see Jackie Robinson, like, in a movie. It's kind of cool to see. Similar to, it's kind of cool to see Babe Ruth in Pride of the Yankees.
Mm-hmm.
But in 42, for all the people who wanted to know why I don't have 42 in my top 15, it feels like a heavily Hollywoodized version of Jackie Robinson's story. Like the tones, the movie's perspective on racism was so heavy-handed that I'm genuinely surprised there was not a scene where, like, Pee-wee Reese walked up to Jackie Robinson and said, "You are a black man. I am a white man, but we are not different. And people who think we are different are bad people." Like, it was just hitting you over the head. Like, it's a good story. And, you know, credit to the actors who, the performances are good. All around, Chadwick Boseman is very good. Harrison Ford does well as Branch Rickey. But it just, the writing feels very, just, I don't know, it feels very like, the best thing I can think of, like, The Blind Side. Like, it feels like a Hollywood movie. And I think Jackie Robinson's story was a bit more complicated and a bit more difficult than that. It wasn't, I mean, they portray the difficulty that Robinson went through a bit in 42, obviously, but it was a bit, I don't know, Robinson's story was a bit dirtier and a bit more complicated than what 42 shows. It just feels like they took Jackie Robinson's story and filtered it through Hollywood.
And they needed Billy Crystal to do it like he did in 61.
That would have been perfect. A genuine look at Jackie Robinson would have been really cool. And having Chadwick Boseman play Jackie Robinson would have been great. I mean, Chadwick Boseman was very good.
Yep.
The performances were not a problem. It's just the writing was not great. And it just, it felt like it hammered you over the head with, like, racism is bad.
They need to focus on the baseball aspect of it. A little more would have been good.
Yeah, just like, a balance. Just a little more subtlety, honestly, is what I wanted. It just felt like a Hollywood movie. But anyways, for all the people who asked me about For the Love of the Game in 42, that's why they are not in my top 15. They are not far outside of my top 15. Mm-hmm. I don't hate them by any stretch, but that's why they're not there. So
yeah, no, I'm with you. I have them close. I was actually, you know, that one, those ones you could, like, Cobb is kind of interesting. The Scout, like, I have a couple just outside.
Oh, Bang the Drum Slowly.
Yep.
I had that at number 16, actually. And I like Bang the Drum Slowly, but again, some issues with the writing. They kind of jump. There's just, like, this weird message of, like, you know, if you're a mentally handicapped friend is dying, then you should be nice to him. Like, don't bully people unless they're dying. And there's, like, that felt a little weird. But also, like, talking about baseball movies that nobody complained this is not in my top 15, and I wondered why. Basketball? Have you seen Basketball?
I enjoy Basketball. Like, I wouldn't put it on my baseball list.
I wouldn't necessarily put it in my, it's not in my top 15, but, like, no, basketball's fun.
That's what I'm saying. If you just want to, like, turn your brain off for, like, an hour and a half and laugh a little,
right,
I think there's nothing wrong with it at all.
It's Trey Parker and Matt Stone, directed South by David Park Zucker, guys, who did, you know, Airplane and mm-hmm. Top Secret and all the, and Naked Gun and all those movies. So, like, just David Zucker directing, Trey Parker and Matt Stone writing in the late 90s, you know this is going to be a just banally stupid movie.
Yeah, like, literally, like, none of it's supposed to make sense. Like, none of it.
Yeah.
And it doesn't.
It doesn't, and it's stupid, but it's fun. There's a lot of it that hasn't, like, superly aged well. But there's a lot of David Zucker style here that I love. And probably my favorite thing that David Zucker does in his 80s movies, David Zucker, Jim Abrams as well, all those Zucker, Abrams, Zucker movies, they make stupid, crazy, funny things happen in the background of serious scenes. I love that. And the other thing they do is they make very serious people do very stupid things.
They're very good at that. Like you mentioned Naked Guns and Airplanes and stuff. Like they're perfect for that.
Well, the thing about Airplane was every single actor in Airplane was a dramatic actor at the time. And like Leslie Nielsen was a serious dramatic actor. Peter Graves, I mean, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar wasn't really an actor, but none of those people in that movie were comedians.
Yep.
And they are all playing their roles very dramatically and very seriously, but they're saying just the dumbest stuff.
Yep.
And David Zucker does that in basketball with Al Michaels and Bob Costas, who are just
so
like, whoever thought you would hear Bob Costas at some point say, "Feel these nipples." Like,
yeah.
It's so funny you mentioned it
because it was actually on TV the other day, and I was like just kind of doing some like writing on my computer, so I just put it on in the background. I just kept catching myself like not paying attention to my computer and watching it, going, "This is pretty funny. Like this is good.
It's so stupid." But I like stupid humor. I love stupid. Yeah.
I like part of the thing about entertainment, TV, movies. A lot of it sometimes it's just get a release from reality. It's like turn your brain off and relax for a bit. And that's why I'm a very sarcastic person. That's why I like a lot of comedies. I like dramatic movies, don't get me wrong, but if I can watch a comedy, I'll watch a comedy over drama any day of the week.
It's interesting you say so. I firmly believe my generation and I don't know, are we different generations? What year were you born?
I was born in 83.
Okay, so yeah, you're Gen X then, I believe, and I'm a millennial because I was born in 90.
Yep.
So, but I think our generations really accepted stupid humor.
Yes.
In a way that previous generations didn't. Like you look at stand-up comedy of the 70s and early 80s, a lot of the 80s, but it wasn't stupid. And then you get like the thing I think of is like Conan O'Brien. Like Conan O'Brien is so good at being so stupid.
Well, just think of it real simple. Just think, look at one of the, okay, I don't know, best actors, but let's look at one of the most successful actors in our time, Adam Sandler.
Oh,
and look
for
at
sure,
the movies
yeah.
he's made. Billy Madison, Happy Gilmore, he's got on the list.
So
they're dumber than dumb.
Will Ferrell.
Yes.
Will Ferrell movies. I love Will Ferrell movies. They are so stupid.
Yes, they're dumb.
Like,
they're stupid.
I saw Step Brothers just a few weeks ago, and I was like, "This is the dumbest movie," and I love it.
Yes,
like it just.
Did we
I
just become
like,
best friends?
Yeah, yeah. It's so dumb, but I feel like we really like just leaned into stupid humor, and it's just the most fun thing. I love it. It's so funny. It feels like it's a generational thing. Like like the millennials and Gen X, we just kind of like. Love stupidity because it just
I think it's absurd. Yeah, like a good laugh, I think, so therapeutic. Like if you can just laugh about something, because there's so much. Well, right now, especially so much bad in the world, and just everything's taken so seriously sometimes.
Yeah,
that, man, a good laugh just goes so far.
And that's why I loved Conan O'Brien so much. Mm-hmm. That's why I loved watching Late Night because it was just so different. It was so different from Jay Leno, who was right before it. I used to watch Leno. I would watch a Tonight Show, and Leno felt like, you know, my parents' comedian. Mm-hmm. Or like the guy who was funny to my dad.
Yeah, he'd have the dad jokes and stuff.
Yeah, yeah. It was very standard, you know, "Hey, did you hear about this?" Like that kind of very standard comedy, which is fine. But Conan, for me, felt like that was my comedy. Like Conan did the dumbest stuff. And it was so funny to me, you know, he would do this bit on Late Night where in like 2004, he would be doing this thing called In the Year 2000. And it would be a look into the future, like just stupid stuff. That was just so funny. And it really feels like I remember my dad watching stuff like Conan and he'd be like, "This is really dumb. Like what is so funny?" And I'm like, "I don't know. Yes. It's just, that's why it's funny. It's so stupid. Like that's what's funny."
I 100% like agree with you. Thing. It's got to be. And that's it's kind of, we've been going full circle on that between the movies and these other things. It's just generational. when you grow up and what you experience goes a long ways with nostalgia, and then just what you enjoy, and it's the humor part of things is great. And that's why I think that's another reason why Major League 3, I don't know, I just took this full circle on us here, but Major League 3, it's a little more laughable than Major League 2, let's put it that way. Because at least it's like poor minor league people that you can kind of be like, oh gosh, like really? It's kind of something along those lines.
Now that you say that, I could see that, because Major League 2 felt like it was
like they all made money now. They're all famous. They're all like trying to do something they weren't.
Well, Major League 2 felt like it was trying. Like, yes. It almost like it was trying too hard.
Yep.
It was trying to be like, it was trying to capitalize on Major League.
Yep.
So I could see back to the minors being like, eh, screw it. You know, like what, you know, who knows? We'll just toss something out there and maybe it'll be stupid. I could see that. Whereas Major League 2 was like, oh yeah, we'll do Major League again and just kind of make money. So yeah, I could see that. I'll have to watch it. We'll have to have Dave on, and we'll have to all talk about it. Maybe I'll love it. Who knows?
Yes, we will definitely do that. That's on the list, because I have a feeling we'll be without baseball for a little while. So we're going to talk movies.
Oh, my God, I know.
It sucks. I hate, like I tell people on Twitter when I post things, I'm trying to stay optimistic. And I even started posting, if you have a negative comment, direct it elsewhere. Because I'm trying to stay positive here.
How are you writing fantasy content right now? Like, Not like an accusatory way, but like
no, it's I know what you're saying. What I'm doing for the most part is in my head I'm planning for like say 100 games for now. Like I'm being realistic, mid June, early July. I'm like early July at the earliest things what we're getting. Like that's just in a perfect world, that's what's happening. And if that's the case, I'm thinking 100 games unless they do something crazy. So
yeah,
in my head I'm going that route. And for the most part, things I'm writing is more still like ADP biases, like this, debates and things along those lines, or later round targets. I'm trying not to get too much into projections and stuff like that.
Yeah, that's that same here. Like I was, I just wrote today actually, and it'll probably come out in a few days, a sleepers article I did.
I've been doing a couple of those.
I took a break from. The last article I wrote was probably 3 weeks ago, if not more, because once MLB made that announcement, I was kind of like, what do I do?
It's tough, man.
It was partly that, and partly my day job is as a healthcare reporter. So this virus has been just making me very busy. But I just kind of like, I was like, I don't know. What am I going to write about? Like, I'm going to write about like, hey, you know, prepare for your drafts, which are happening who knows when. So yeah, I finally got back into it, and it's sort of discouraging. It's a bummer, but we will have baseball. It will happen at the very least.
We're going to get something. I really do think unless this thing takes like a horrible turn, we're going to get something one way or another. Like they're going to put something out there. I'm a believer in that. Just how much is the question. And if it doesn't happen, it's going to be really depressing. But
well, there's a lot of talk about, you know, doing a lot of doubleheaders during the week, at least one doubleheader per week. So
What I think the idea I think that might work, possibly work, but it's going to like you have to change baseball for the year. Like literally just turn your brain off and go, okay, we're doing something different this year. It's basically the Cactus League versus the Grapefruit League, and the winner of each league faces off for the playoffs. Like that way you can limit travel. Like they're all right in that area. You don't have to go all over the place. You play in your minor league, your spring training facilities, because with no fans, you don't need all the seats. It's still a ballpark. I know it'll be a lot hotter, so that's going to stink for the summertime. Like that's a big deal, but I think that's one way to limit the exposure per se. So
I don't know what's going to happen. It's weird. It was so funny because Pitcher List, we were ramping up for the preseason so much, and then MLB kind of this whole virus and everything kind of took the rug out from under us, and we're like, whoa, what do we do now? So now we're doing like. We're reviewing classic games and stuff like that. MLB is doing that too for tomorrow.
I saw that. They have all kinds, all different channels have all kinds of cool stuff.
Yeah, the Delman Young double, the ALDS game two for the Orioles. Yeah, man.
Well, I've been loving it. I've been watching. They did the World Baseball Classic. I was watching that the other day. They've been doing like one class. The Burley Perfect Game was on the other day. They've had some other ones. I can watch baseball, period. Like, you're a baseball fan. Right. I'm a baseball fan. So, like, just put it on, and I'm probably going to – like a moth to a flame eventually.
So, for me as an Orioles fan, the Delman Young double, every Orioles fan who hears that is like, yeah, I know what that is, and I've seen it 1,000 times. Is there a single play or like just something in baseball that you've seen like 100 times because it just fills you with so much joy?
Yes, and it people would think it's the World Series that in 2010, which was. I remember exactly where I was when the last out was made. Like,
is that the one where Sandoval catches it and falls on the ground?
No, I believe that was 12 against the Royals. This was against Texas in Texas, 2010. But I think it was a strikeout too with Brian Wilson.
Okay.
But for me, it was when I was a kid, and people that followed me on Twitter, they know Will Clark's my favorite player. He's my avatar. It's the NLCS for Chicago when Clark takes him deep in Wrigley Field. I have watched that game so many times. When we talked about scorekeeping last episode in junior high, one of our elective classes was scorekeeping. We actually kept score to that game. We sat in class, watched that game, and kept score. I can picture Will Clark, his swing, putting that into the right center field bleachers in Wrigley all the time. It's amazing.
Will Clark, that's a former Oriole.
No, he's a former Giant that played for the Orioles. No,
he happened to play for the Orioles. He signed a 2-year deal with them. And
yeah, those late years were tough with the Orioles, the Cardinals, the Rangers. That was a rough guy.
Last season. Was it the Orioles? He had one more year
Cardinals,
after that.
Cardinals, maybe.
That's right. He had one more year after that because he signed a 2-year deal with the Orioles. And he replaced my favorite player, which is Rafael Palmeiro.
I was about to say, that'd be right after Rafael. Because then he went Rafael to Texas after Baltimore.
Yeah, he did. And then he came back. But, oh, God, I love Rafael Palmeiro. And you want to talk about, like, it is tough having Rafael Palmeiro as your favorite player.
Yeah, to be fair, I understand, because if it wasn't for Clark, I am a huge Barry Bonds fan. And it's
I would imagine, yeah.
It's not popular.
As a Giants fan, sure, I would imagine.
Yeah. It was so much fun to watch one of the best hitters to ever play. But so I get it. I totally understand.
Palmeiro was so good. Like there's a good defense for Palmeiro, though. Honestly, there's a solid defense that Palmeiro only took steroids in 05 when he got caught.
Yeah.
Like he testified before Congress, did the finger point and everything. I did not use steroids, period. Yeah, and when he got caught, so he got caught and he said, I don't know. The only thing I got was some vitamin shots from Miguel Tejada. And everybody was like,
also.
But at the time, everyone was like, Tejada? No, he's just making stuff up. And then a few years later, Tejada gets caught with steroids. And nobody makes a connection that, hey, maybe Palmeiro was just an idiot and took a random shot from his teammate. I don't know. I have a very, very strong belief that Rafael Palmeiro should be in the Hall of Fame. Like,
I think, honestly, I have an argument that I think all steroid guys should be, and that should be a steroid. Yeah. It should be a steroid wing, because we talked about it last episode.
Oh, that's absolutely crazy. But Palmeiro has over 500 home runs and over 3,000 hits.
Yeah.
He was one of what, 6-7 people now, including A-Rod?
Yeah, like Palmeiro, Bonds, Clemens, these guys need to be in the Hall of Fame.
Yeah, I know. I love Palmeiro so much. What a swing, man.
He had a good one.
Look at YouTube, his swing. It's the most beautiful swing you will ever see a human.
I'm biased. I think Will Clark's is better, but that's just a bias.
That's fair. It was so smooth and so sweet, and I was so sad when he went to the Rangers. Anyways,
something about those lefties. Those lefties have those smooth swings.
And he was a gold glove first baseman. Yes. Honestly, yes, he was. He was so good. He was so good. I love him so much. Anyways, we've gone way over time.
That's fine. No, like there's no time limit. I just love, that's what I love about
whatever.
This
podcast. What, I mean, the people who are listening, what are you doing? Like, I mean, you're at home. I hope you're at home.
We're giving you some baseball joy. So enjoy it.
Exactly.
Yeah, we'll wrap it up there, and we'll do our top five coming up here in the next few weeks. Don't forget to check out Ben on Twitter at Ben J Palmer. I'm at B. Dientrich, and it's always fun talking a little baseball. So this is Bench Bub episode 265, Baseball Movies. Catch you guys later.
better with a home policy from American Family Insurance. Because you'll feel protected no matter how the wind blows. Also, you can keep enjoying the home of your dreams. And our expert agents can help you save up to 23% when you bundle home with auto. Insure carefully. Dream fearlessly. American Family Insurance. Get a quote? Find an agent at AmFam.com.
Products not available in every state. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.